with another story from the series Lost and Found Sound, our search through America's recorded legacy. 100 years ago today, a hurricane struck Galveston, Texas, killing at least 6,000 people on the island, another 4,000 to 6,000 on the mainland. It remains the worst recorded natural disaster in the history of the United States. Today, we bring you the story No Tongue Can Tell, remembering the 1900 Galveston storm. The voices you'll hear come from oral histories, letters, and memoirs of storm survivors. The storm sounds were added in the studio. Our story was produced and narrated by John Burnett of NPR News in collaboration with Davia Nelson.
A century after the great 1900 storm, Galveston is finally commemorating the event that nearly erased it from the map. Today, there were plans for a candlelight memorial and a plaque dedication, special plays and symposiums. Why did it take Galveston so long to publicly acknowledge what happened 100 years ago? For a BOI perspective, that means born on the island, I asked the city's former state senator, Babe Schwartz.
As I grew up in Galveston, people didn't talk about the 1900 storm. Basically, I think Galveston's attitude was it's bad for business. No chamber of commerce wants to talk about the worst tragedy in the history of the United States, where 6,000 or 8,000 people died on this little old island. The folks that survived the storm were sort of like people who survived a war. It was so terrible, and the impact was so great in their memory that they'd rather not talk about it. It's not good social conversation.
But over the years, they did tell their stories of the flood when they were asked.
On Saturday the 8th, Ella, our cook, prepared the Sunday dinner as usual. She cooked a 6-pound veal rump roast and made a cake, which was to go with a pitcher of boiled custard that my mother had planned for dessert. Everyone went about their usual tasks until about 11 a.m., when my brother Jacob, 11 years of age, and our cousin Alan Brooks, age 13, who was spending a month with us, came from the beach with a report that the gulf was very rough and the tide very high. About 3:30, Jacob and Alan came running, shouting excitedly that the gulf looked like a great gray wall about 50 feet high moving slowly toward the island.
Catherine Vetter Pauls was not quite 6 years old at the dawn of the 20th century. In that year, her home of Galveston was the most important city in Texas. It could claim the biggest port, the most millionaires, the best theaters, the grandest mansions, the first telephones and electric lights, and more saloons than New Orleans. Galveston was a sensuous city where people came to bathe in the warm Gulf and have a good time. It was also the most vulnerable, built on a skinny barrier island only 5 feet above sea level. Yet the city enjoyed a false sense of security. Years before, the local Weather Bureau official, Isaac M. Klein, had written how it was an absurd delusion that Galveston could be damaged by a killer storm because of the gentle slope of the Gulf. On the eve of the huge hurricane, no one was overly concerned.
And I seem to recall our entire time, it sat on our front porch and enjoyed the cool breezes. We had no inkling of a severe storm approaching.
12-year-old Hyman Block lived with his parents and four brothers and sisters on Winnie Street.
I guess our first realization of something bad was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We noticed some lumber floating by, and the people were then commencing to seek shelter at the courthouse. We could hear the cows mooing and the dogs barking, the shouting in one thing or another.
Oh, we knew there was a storm coming, but we had no idea it was as bad as it was. See, we didn't have a weather bureau that give us the dope that they got now.
Well, then all you knew was that there was a storm out there.
Oh, yes, they knew there was a storm then, but they had no airplane, you know, to go out there and see how bad it was.
That was William Mason Bristol, who was 21 when he rode out the storm in his mother's boarding house in the east end of Galveston. In those early days of forecasting, before storms had names, no one knew the intensity of the anonymous tempest sweeping in from the Gulf. And so Galveston's 37,000 residents were never warned to evacuate. On the contrary, people thought it was fun. Families walked to the beach to watch the big breakers, and kids played with driftwood floating down the streets.
My name is Isola Ethel Bedford Collins. This voice that you're going to hear on the tape is of my mother's aunt, Mrs. Annie Smizer McCullough. She was about 22 years old in 1900 when the storm came.
Isola, it's so much to tell you about it till I don't know what to start to telling you.
Wherever you want to start.
Oh, it was an awful thing you want me to tell you, but it's no tongue can tell it. When I got to the corner of 9th and Broadway on the south side, the wind was so strong and those waves was coming so... Well, I don't guess you want to hear all of that.
Yes, you do. Go ahead.
And the water was coming so fast. The wagon is getting so it was floating. The poor mules swimming that was pulling. And the men laid flat at his stomach, holding the little children.
The 1900 storm was what we now call a Category 4 hurricane. Winds were estimated at 120 miles per hour, and the storm surge reached 15 feet. Men saw 6-foot waves coming down Broadway. Galveston Bay behind and the Gulf of Mexico in front became one and swallowed Galveston. Survivors remember the wind as it invaded their homes. It sounded like a thousand little devils shrieking and whistling, wrote one. Louise Bristol Hopkins was 7 years old that night.
My mother, when she realized that the water was going to come in the house, mm-hmm. that it was coming under the door, under the house, in the house, the first floor, mm-hmm. she went out to where she chopped kindling wood for the stove, you know, there was no gas, no electricity.
Right.
And got an axe, and she chopped holes in every floor of every room downstairs, in the hallway, in the kitchen, in the dining room, mm-hmm. so the water would come up into the house and held the house on the foundation.
Right, and not floated off the foundation.
Yes.
Yeah.
What survivors describe are the sounds of a city coming apart. The wind turned slate shingles into whirling saw blades. The surf demolished a streetcar track, and the rails became waterborne battering rams against houses. One man reported looking up at a grand piano riding the crest of a wave.
The wind was picking up, and in those days everybody had shutters on the home. The wind was blowing them off. The slate was coming off that house. It sounded like a freight train passing over the roof of the house.
The animals tried to swim to safety, and the frightened, squawking chickens were roosting everywhere they could get above the water. People from homes already demolished were beginning to drift into our house, which still stood staunchly against the increasing fury of the wind and water.
Catherine Vetter-Pauls and Wilbur Goodman, who was 12, weathered the storm in their own homes. Many others, such as Annie McCullough, took refuge in the sturdy brick Rosenberg School.
It was so crowded, and the people were screaming and hollering so hard, the folks. Oh, the wind, those men that was in the school, all they could do was stand against those doors and hold them.
In the terrifying darkness, mothers and fathers tried desperately to hold their families together. The waves swept children out of their parents' arms. Others were gashed by flying debris.
There were about 24 refugees that we remember that came through the windows there.
The late Galveston banker and philanthropist John W. Harris was 6 years old on September 8th, 1900.
My sister and I were only two children, and mother had a trunk strap around each one of us, and had the to hold on to us as long as she could.
Of all the individual tragedies throughout that endless night, none was greater than the destruction of St. Mary's Orphanage, where 90 children and 10 Catholic nuns died. The orphanage consisted of two wooden dormitories built fewer than 100 yards from the beach in the belief that the ocean breezes would make it safer from yellow fever. Sister Margaret Ann Toomey is General Secretary of the Sisters of Charity of the Incarnate Word, which relocated from Galveston to Houston after the hurricane. She reads here from an account of the storm written by her order this year to commemorate the catastrophe.
Recognizing the severity of the storm, the sisters brought all the children into the girls' dormitory because it was the newer and stronger of the two. To calm the children, the sisters had them sing Queen of the Waves, an old French hymn, traditionally sung during storms by fishermen in France, seeking the protection of Mary, Mother of Jesus, Queen of the Waves. That afternoon, the waters of the Gulf filled the first floor of the dormitory. In an effort to protect the children, the sisters tied the orphans to themselves with clothesline. Each sister tied to herself from 6 to 8 children. It was a valiant yet sacrificial effort. With the winds howling, the sisters and children heard the loud crash of the boys' dormitory as it gave way to the flood waters. Again, they sang the hymn. Eventually, the girls' dormitory was lifted from its foundation by the rising waters and sank. Only 3 boys were able to escape.
Our story on the 1900 Galveston storm and its aftermath will continue in a minute on All Things Considered from NPR News.